ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to the second of our series of Hellenic Observatory Research Seminars, the second of the series for this year. And before I introduce this evening's speaker, I'm under strict instructions from management to announce the next meetings that we have, which are equally important. So on Tuesday the 11th of November, you're all welcome at 6 o'clock in this room to listen to a talk on the newly disadvantaged working class responses to rapid socioeconomic change in Greece by Alexander Kelenis, who is a research associate at King's College, University of Cambridge. And on Friday, the 7th of November, we have a public debate, What is Modern About Modern Greece, in the Hong Kong Theatre. You can find out more about the timings and who's participating in that event on the HO website. But back to the main event, and the main event is tonight's talk on crisis and democracy, democracy and crisis, social anthropological perspectives on the fragility of the social contract. And it's a great pleasure to welcome this evening Dr. Elisabeth Kitsoglu from the University of Durham. Elisabeth is an anthropologist, a social anthropologist. She has studied at the LSE, having done both her master's degree and her PhD here. And she has written extensively on gender, identity, and politics. And her latest book is titled For the Love of Women, Gender Identity and Same-Sex Relationships in a Greek Provincial Town, available through Routledge. Mm. It's a great pleasure to have you here this evening and to hear your thoughts and work on crisis of democracy.
Thank you very much for inviting me here. The present paper wishes to contribute to our understanding of the Greek financial crisis as a byproduct of a deep and chronic political crisis, which, at least after the Second World War, resulted in the systematic generation of multiple spheres of moral, economic, civil, and civic exclusion. The qualitative characteristics of this political crisis have been mostly discussed in the literature under the inclusive terms clientelism, populism, corruption, statism, and they have been deemed responsible for the inefficiency of the Greek state, the lack of competitiveness of the country as a whole, and ultimately for the lack of fiscal discipline that led to the present financial meltdown. My argument today revolves around the idea that in order to appreciate the political circumstances that led to the financial deadlock, we need to contextualize them both historically and in geostrategic terms, firmly placing Greece in the international political map. The immediate consequence of examining local developments as part of global conditions is that we can expand our appreciation of Greek governance, or lack of, beyond taxonomic and dichotomous models of lagging organization. A second outcome of such an approach is that it can offer us a plausible explanation of why a significant part of the Greek public resists, and have resisted even more ferociously in the past, reform and policies, sometimes openly through acts of civil disobedience, rhetorically or through micro-practices of resistance. Through careful ethnographic analysis of local commentary, and by taking this commentary seriously, I wish to demonstrate that the political crisis underpinning the current financial predicament is the aftermath of the very crisis of the social contract, which has been engendering for many decades specific public concerns with sovereignty, democracy, and asymmetrical relations of power. Documenting local patterns of accountability, historical and political causality, and analyzing them in context offers us more than an update on public understandings of the crisis. Indigenous etiology, how people make sense of political affairs, provides unique insights into their preferred avenues of claiming and exercising political agency and participation, and this is the anthropologist's contribution as a discipline to the understanding of the crisis. Patronage and clientelism. Clientelism is a well-known practice in Greece since almost the inception of the Greek state, and it has been analyzed as a structural factor of Greek society in anthropology, most notably by Campbell, who explained how patronage was a mediatory idiom between the state and its citizens. In the last four decades, however, clientelism is seen as having taken a new form in its entanglement with party politics. A number of political scientists have documented the manner in which political parties reinvented, expanded, and strengthened patronage systems in order to control the state machine. In fact, one of the major accusations towards political parties that ruled the country after 1974 is that they institutionalized clientelism, basing on it their own political survival at a period when they ought to have been modernizing the state. Patronage-led politics and clientelist practices are, of course, phenomena not unique to Greece. Older studies of clientelism, most markedly the one by Putnam, regarded clientelism as a feature of certain societies in their early modern development. In its evolutionary framework, this approach postulated that modernization and democratization would render patron-client relationships obsolete. Newer works on clientelism rejected this culturalist approach and documented how clientelism can be a durable political disposition, sometimes increasing rather than decreasing in strength in current economic circumstances. This new tide of studies also tends to analyze clientelism as an important and even versatile feature of everyday politics, as a mechanism of securing benefits and of solving problems of access to resources. In the case of Greece, I propose that we approach clientelism not in its post-1974 role in Greek politics, but as a result of post-Civil War political developments, or else as a Civil War legacy that post-1974 governments had to negotiate. Before I continue to develop my argument, I must at this point justify why I'm using the end of the Second World War as this particular time frame. My first reason is, of course, methodological. Being an anthropologist, I can only work with people who are currently alive and with their memories. And this time period between the Second World War and the present is the time period that my informants use as a frame of reference par excellence when they refer to the crisis, and this has been documented also by other anthropologists. Apart from this methodological limitation, however, I believe that indeed the Second World War marked a new era in local and international politics, somewhat changing the scenery and the players, accentuating the US as a key power in European politics. While some political idioms like patronage and clientelism can indeed be seen as important in the pre-Second World War era, it is difficult to establish a political genealogy which goes that far back in history. Of course, this is by no means an attempt to disregard the importance of historians in these discussions. On the contrary, I believe that if we had further historical evidence that could support historical political genealogies, they would be, of course, more than welcome, but they must be offered by anthropologists and sociologists, by historians and not anthropologists and sociologists or political scientists who usually work with safely within smaller time frames. So I'm going to talk to you about institutionalized inclusion as an antidote to institutionalized exclusion. And what you're seeing here is, on the upper hand, left corner, my left and right are still weak, as my thought is, which is not a good sign. You can see a copy of Epistopeitiko Kinonikon Phronimaton, a national mindedness certificate, and I will explain to you what is that. Then you can see the first page of a right-wing newspaper, Ivravinin, and I will explain to you what is that as well. That's the first page upon the election of PASOK, of the socialist government, and upon the decision that actually people will be employed in the courts and in the police, even without these national mindedness certificates. I will explain to you. George is a man in his late 60s, born in Thessaloniki. His father had joined the ELAS, the National Popular Liberation Army, during the German occupation. His fate after the war was very similar to all other Greeks who have been literally stigmatized as communists. It was difficult for him to find a job, while his whole family was considered guilty by association. His sister, George's aunt, was prohibited from becoming a civil servant, and the whole family was filed by the police as beta citizens, which means crypto-communists. And this is what George told me. Back then, you could do nothing if you did not have a national mind and a certificate. Pistopitiko kinon konfirmato. We lived in poverty, misery, and under persecution. My father was called in the police every so often, and he was frequently dismissed from jobs, since some bosses were afraid that they would be signaled out as communist sympathizers. My father had fought the Germans, only to be persecuted by their collaborators. Go search about the German collaborators. Go search about who were these people who governed Greece after the war was over. What sort of democracy that was? What sort of state was the state of the right? This is why I supported PASOK. I supported Andreas with all my heart and all my power, because he honored the struggle of all those people who suffered for years and years. A number of historical anthropological studies of Greece have indeed documented the anti-communist and repressive character of the Greek states in the post-Civil War era. The role of the British forces until 1946 and from then onwards of the US in the establishment of such a state as part of the Cold War politics is also well recognized in the relevant literature. Historical research clearly attests to the fact that a good number of German collaborators physically, politically, and economically survived, most of the times unpunished or suffering very light sentences, precisely because they made themselves pivotal in the persecution of communists. The Greek military that managed eventually to stage the coup of 1967 derived much of its power by the fact that it was seen as the guarantor of post-Civil War order by the Greek state, but also by the US, whose interference in post-Civil War politics was blatant and almost institutionalized. Without resorting to dependency theories and recognizing the complexity of the relationship between Greece and the US, it is fair to say that post-Civil War politics cannot be understood outside the Cold War climate and the influence of the United States. Most importantly, however, the period after 1974 cannot be sufficiently analyzed without taking into consideration the post-Civil War legacy. The Greek Socialist Party, PASOK, and especially the political figure of Andreas Papandreou, was literally adored by large segments of the Greek population. As one of my informants once told me, I would rather hear you insult my mother than Andreas Papandreou. And I will say this in Greek, because, you know, Greek speakers would really feel it. Εμένα καλύτερα να μου έβριζες τη μάνα παρά τον Ανδρέα, he said. These are the posters that PASOK was using for its electoral campaign, and it says, for freedom and civil rights for everyone, I vote for PASOK. The new Greece belongs to all of us. So the allusions are quite obvious. Yes, I was employed as a civil servant when PASOK was governing. Μπήκα στο δημόσιο επί PASOK. Yes, I was employed because I supported PASOK. But ask me why my father could have never been employed. Ask what my family had to endure because they were stigmatized as leftists. And this is Stratos, 60-year-old from Thessaloniki. It is certainly true that PASOK initiated a new era in clientelist politics, readily followed by Nea Δημοκρατία. It is also important to recognize that through PASOK and Andreas Papandreou, the Greek public sought to publicly negotiate a collective political trauma that can be traced back in the Civil War and the post-Civil War period and to gain open and official recognition in its existence. A number of scholars admit that Andreas Papandreou laid claim to the ideological heritage of the arm of the Communist Party during the Civil War and fostered a political culture in opposition to the traditional right, as this has been experienced until 1974. Undoubtedly, the Junta period exacerbated the post-Civil War injuries suffered by large parties of the Greek population and radicalized yet another generation, further promoting this cleavage between the victors and the vanquished of the Civil War, instituting new dividing lines in Greek society. Karamanlis' moderation in 1974 was certainly a step towards the direction of national reconciliation, but it was probably not enough. The radical rhetoric of Papandreou, as well as his decision to encourage the average person who felt excluded, either personally or by family association, to the traditional left, to fight their way back into the state through clientelism, offered to large segments of the Greek public a symbolic sense of settlement with the past. Besides viewing the post-1974 era of clientelism as an era of retribution, I claim that in our attempt to understand these particular forms of governance, we must pay closer attention to the state of the right as a byproduct of international politics in the post-Civil War era. Το κράτος της δεξιάς should not be translated as the rightist state, but literally as the state of the right, the state which belonged to the right, marking a political era where attitudes to the state as some citizens' private property were solidified. They didn't start then, but they were solidifying then. Local politics, which cannot be understood separately from the Cold War and the interests of the US in the larger geopolitical area of the Mediterranean, led to the systematic creation of spheres of exclusion, out of which the politically dangerous subject was born. To paraphrase Foucault, as a species. The politically dangerous subject of the post-Civil War period did not and could not coincide with the concept of the individual citizen. The creation of civil categories by association not only radicalized at least two generations of citizens, but also instituted, strengthened, or to say the least, failed to change the collectivist basis of great politics. At the very opposite end of these spheres of exclusion, and by consequence of their existence, new elites were created, as inequalities and asymmetries between citizens proliferated, not on the basis of different economic development of groups, but as a consequence of ideological taxonomies. What is more, it is perhaps for this particular era, and for the specific local international political reasons, that we find the strong roots of state nepotism and state-driven development in Greece. In order to explicate my claim, I will use an extensive quotation from Featherstone's enlightening work, Varieties of Capitalism. The tradition of state-driven development in Southern Europe is central to Greece's history. Pavoulatos, for example, identifies Greece in the post-war period as a weak and incomplete developmental state based on a state-driven policy pattern with a protected market and a deeply underdeveloped civil society. The late or late-late industrialization of Greece and its dependence on the Greek diaspora and on the foreign capital meant that the state filled a domestic vacuum. The state exercised disproportionate influence over the economy through extensive regulation, protectionist measures, transfers and subsidies. Moreover, these instruments were applied in a particularistic manner with the state subject to a pervasive rent-seeking behavior and favoring certain sectors and interests, and the emphasis is mine. After the Second World War, Greece depends on the influx of foreign capital, especially in the form of direct aid by the U.S., The aim of U.S. foreign policy, in turn, is the strengthening and preservation of fellow-U.S. and openly anti-communist regimes. This specific political and historical context becomes a fertile ground for the formation of a strong state compelled to keep a tight control over the distribution of resources. Simultaneously, political conditions provided an excellent chance for the creation and strengthening of local elites, either on an ideological basis or using the ideological basis as an excuse, in a climate where monopolistic tendencies thrived due mainly to indiscriminate and nepotistic state protectionism. Engendering the progressive democratic subject, απόψε πεθαίνει η δεξιά. Tonight the right is dying, and that was a very popular electoral how do you call it? Of PASOK. The victory of PASOK in the 1981 elections was celebrated as the victory of the progressive democratic forces, Προοδευτικές Δυνάμεις, over the conservative forces of the right, Συντηρητικές Δυνάμεις της Δεξιάς. PASOK, as a political party, facilitated the ordinary citizen, the average person, in their attempt to take part through clientelism to political power in an idiosyncratic attempt to democratize the highly exclusionist state of the past. In the first years of PASOK, if you were not a member of the local organization, Klaviki, your fate was sealed. I have seen amazing things. Porters becoming directors overnight. Yannis, 53, bank employee. In 1982, I was working already 20 years in the public sector. As a senior, I was assigned to a position of responsibility. PASOK was in power less than a year when I was downgraded. My post was given to a girl 10 years younger than me, the one I was teaching how to hold the pen. Στο κοριτσάκι που της μάθαινα πώς να πιάνει το μολύβι. Because she was PASOK, and I wasn't. Her family were leftists for donkey's years. Do you know what was more frustrating? It was not me who persecuted the leftists. My own father was a trade unionist, but I had to pay for the sins of the right. And I was not even compensated for it. Νέα Δημοκρατία never managed to protect me, to compensate me for what I went through while in service. Kiki, 76 years old, pensioner, ex-public sector employee, and traditional Νέα Δημοκρατία supporter, the not compensated alludes to the fact that her son was never actually given a post in the public service by Νέα Δημοκρατία. The historian Kostas Kostis offers historical documentation of the changes in the structure of the public sector, which allowed for political criteria to play a decisive role in the staffing of the public sector, especially in senior management positions. Despite instituting a whole new form of governance, through forging specific and explicit relations between the state and the party, clientelism, as practiced by PASOK, was not radically different in its inception from the politics of inclusion and exclusion initiated in the post-Civil War era. The place of the nation-minded was filled by yet a new kind of political subject, the progressive democratic citizen. Post-1980s clientelism created new spheres of exclusion as it paradoxically sought to address the asymmetries engendered by the state of the right. As political parties took their turns in office, this kind of party-led clientelism, or partitocratia as it has been termed by Lyridzis, became the par excellence feature of Greek governance. The Greek polity remained collectivist in character, and both PASOK and Nea Dimokratia were transformed in almost official, and certainly official in practice, patronage networks that owed first and foremost to their supporters cum clients who waited patiently their party's turn in order to gain beneficial access to the resources of the state. As clientelism proliferated in the arts, academia, the media and business, wherever there was power to appoint and grant access to benefits, goods, services, influences and honors. What is perhaps an important feature of Greek clientelism is that it concerns the higher socioeconomic strata as much as the middle, petit bourgeoisie and the working class. It thus becomes difficult to differentiate between clientelism, state nepotism and corruption. State nepotism, unavoidably with ideological overtones, was certainly a characteristic of the post-Civil War era. Preferential access to the state never ceased to exist as new forms of clientelism inspired by different ideological platforms emerged after 1974. Patronage-ridden politics kept creating new elites, while also at times strengthening existing ones, paradoxically and simultaneously, and proliferated asymmetries between citizens. Whether we choose to call this patronage or patronage-instituted corruption or the aploki, to use the Greek term which connotes the entanglement of the state with the private sector, big enterprises and the media, the end result is the same. The state relations with not just citizens but also the private sector as a whole and the real economy are characterized by, and I'm quoting Featherstone again, the preeminence of a small number of enterprise networks and especially their individual heads who possess a strong public profile and have privileged access to and influence over the party state, which in turn affects the policy planning and allocative decisions of relevance to their particular interests. By contrast, there is the relative political weakness of the vast majority of Greek enterprises vis-à-vis the state. The aforementioned conditions of Greek political-economic affairs created a spiral of further reliance of citizens to the state and the need for further micro-corruption in order to get things done, and rendered the ordinary life of Greek people, either in their capacity as citizens or in their roles as entrepreneurs, a perpetual navigation through the maze of an indifferent bureaucracy which has been constructed to include and exclude, frequently in a haphazard manner, as various laws and policies may have been instituted in the past with a particular case in mind, and not as part of a bigger plan. the proliferation of bureaucracy, parts of which were frequently created to serve an influential head of an enterprise network, a high party official, or some other political entrepreneur, does not mirror any more ideological communities, political parties, or any other such collectivity. The state mechanism has become much larger and infinitely more complicated than expected. As an informant of mine once told me, if you want to understand what Greek state is about, go to the planning services, Polyvomia. Unless you have a friend in there, there is no way you can have your job finished. Clientelism and micro practices of corruption between citizens and lower officials cannot at this point be analyzed as the natural opposites of meritocracy and fair play. They have become institutions, means through which the everyday citizen attempts to mediate between not only themselves and the state, but also between themselves and the elites that this very scheme has created. In this sense, institutionalized clientelism and micro-practices of corruption have become, to echo Javier Agüero, the politics of the poor, a way to diffuse power and to exercise some kind of political and civil agency, a struggle to command day-to-day experience, and a paradoxical form of civil participation. They can drop dead, all of them. Do you know how much is the emergency tax I'm asked to pay for my house? Why, mister, have we built this house together? Have you worked as a taxi driver 20 hours a day to pay for my house and I don't know it? Why? Is this democracy? When did we have democracy in Greece and I missed it? It was always the foreigners, the xeni, meaning the great powers, who decided on our fates, and our politicians just facilitated and executed their decisions. Kostas, 53 years old, taxi driver, Thessaloniki, Greece. What do they, meaning politicians, know about life, about work, about struggles, about democracy? Where did they learn about these things? In Harvard, when they were studying in adjacent rooms and alluding to the fact that Samaras and George Papandreou were studying together in Harvard. I think they were sharing a room at some point. Do they feel the crisis? Their children are secure. Mine are unemployed. Who will come to give me lessons in democracy? Do you see my hands? Look at mine and look at theirs. When have they ever worked? Get the 47-year-old, now unemployed, Kalamaria, Thessaloniki. When have they ever worked? What does this crisis mean to them? They don't care. Their children will not remain unemployed. They will not hungry. They will not go hungry. Do you understand? They have absolutely no idea, no concept of what it is to be like, not knowing what the future will bring to you and your family. Danai, 55, private employee. Her daughter with a degree in philosophy is working full-time in retail. Her net salary is reportedly 380 euros per month. These guys were a gang. They were a cartel. They only cared about themselves and their partners, the local and the foreign. They were a small company who used us, fooled us, and now they're selling our homeland to the Germans. They took our vote, our money, the struggles of an entire life, of two and three generations sometimes, and now they're here pretending that they will save us. Do you see this house? I spent my life in half a slipper to make it. I paid for my husband's health when things got serious. I paid extra tuition fees for my children to enter university. What did the state ever do for me? Antonia's comment, similarly to many other informants, reflects, among other things, the extent to which the Greek people, in all their attempts to gain access to state resources through party patronage networks, could not actually rely on the state for much of their needs. It is common knowledge in Greece that everyone's children are educated privately, some of them full-time in fully paid private schools, and most of them part-time, on selective subjects only, in afternoon private tuition establishments, Phrodisteria. It is also common knowledge in Greece that the private sector paid badly and offered notoriously unstable employment. In the absence of a sensible welfare state, ordinary citizens seek relentlessly the job security that the public sector has to offer, and, once employed as public servants, protect ferociously the benefits and privileges of their positions. Public services, such as the health system, were never entirely reliable, and Andreas Papandreou was neither the first nor the last to come to the UK for an open-heart surgery, although admittedly private hospitals have absorbed in the last two decades a larger number of people who were previously travelling outside Greece for critical health problems. The state has become the number one employer. Of course it has, but this is not just because the political parties wanted to create a voting army of their own. It also relates to a number of other reasons, some of them distinctly connected to the international economic sphere. In the age of globalization, Greek salaries could not compete with those of South Asia or even the Balkans. This is how we decided to transfer the textile industry to Bulgaria before eventually selling it out. The Greek seamstress was better at her job than the Bulgarian one. She was producing less wastage, but she was infinitely more expensive. Where would Greek people find jobs? In some ways, if it was not for the civil sector, we would have a revolution in Greece well before the beginning of the 90s. And this is Kyriaki 58, Kalamaria, Thessaloniki. A number of historians and economists admit that the Greek fiscal system was unequal and that Greece was a poverty-ridden country characterized profusely by socio-economic inequalities in the beginning of the 80s. The most impressive quotes, however, are to be found in the classic book by Mouzelis, Modern Greece Facets of Underdevelopment. Precisely because it was written in 1978 and from the outmost possible distance from the polarized climate of current debates, we can find extremely interesting quotes in it. In his last chapter, Capitalism and Dictatorship in Post-War Greece, Mouzelis states that the country managed to attract concentrated doses of foreign direct investment, but at the cost of greatly amplifying inequalities at home. If one now considers the situation in the cities, income differentials, he says, can be seen to have been not only enormous, but continuously increasing. Finally, the leniency of the state vis-à-vis big capital reaches its zenith in the enormous privileges accorded to foreign capital. Taking into account the variety of the privileges which foreign and mixed capital enjoy in Greece, it would not be an exaggeration to say, and that's in 1978, that in many cases industrial expenses and risks are socialized, whereas the fruits of any such industrial success go solely to private capital. In other words, the state revenue derived from taxation of low incomes is mainly used to consolidate and develop big capital. The social unrest and political mobilization of the 50s and 60s is attributed by Mouzelis precisely to this uneven development of the forces and relations of production. The conclusion of the book argues that Greece will never be able to catch up with Western social democracies because it is completely lacking a welfare state, which he characterizes as a basic presupposition of a stable and open parliamentary system, and because its social inequalities are much greater and grow much faster than in the rest of Europe. If the state were to make fundamental changes in the country's structure of income and wealth distribution, it would no longer offer the favorable climate for private investments it offers today. In such circumstances, why should capital choose to enter or remain in Greece? In many ways, then, we cannot but agree that some of the most important structural, political, and economic vulnerabilities of Greece are not idiosyncratic to the country, and they cannot be viewed separately from international events. I hope I have demonstrated that partitocratia cannot be understood independently of the post-Civil War Cold War climate. What is more, the devastating defeat of the left in Greece in the Civil War meant that the country possessed nothing comparable to the social compromise forged elsewhere in Europe in the 50s and 60s. No welfare state, no democratic party, wage levels continued to be miserably low, and workplace regimes were very repressive. Third, the post-1974 political system had to deal with civil, economic, and political inequalities that were an indispensable part of the Cold War climate, while the forms of capital accumulation were the same internationally, both in their character and in their effects. Lastly, clientelism as partitocratia was a form of dealing with various forms of political exclusion of the past, created out of clientelism a state, nepotism. In the absence of a welfare system, this latter form of clientelism was a simplistic, crude, spillover mechanism of profits and power to wider sections of the population, which of course resulted in the proliferation of spheres of exclusion and a Kafka-style bureaucracy which rendered party patronage and the various micro-practices of corruption almost necessary for taking care of daily affairs. Both the state nepotism of the pre-1974 and partitocracia created and sustained political and economic elites with privileged access to state resources, a condition which hindered economic development and damaged the citizens' appreciation of democracy, transparency, and equality as par excellence dimensions of the social contract. A final note by way of conclusion. Constructing the parochial subject. Much has been said about the Greek people's resistance to reform attempts. Recently, Mitsopoulos and Pelagidis have stated that the Greeks are nationally ignorant and misinformed voters who are afraid of reform. According to the authors, Greeks, when faced with a determined reformer, will quickly identify the loss they stand to incur should the rule of law suddenly apply. They find it much more difficult to relate to the promises of increased competitiveness that seem more distant and uncertain. They seem to feel more secure in the current environment in which the state distributes rewards, not according to merit, but in a haphazard way, depending on participation in interest groups, affiliations with the political establishment, and other criteria. The key word here, which demonstrates the accuracy of the author's analysis, is suddenly. Indeed, the Greeks, as anyone else I suppose, are quick to identify the loss they stand to incur should meritocracy was to be suddenly introduced. It does not take much to understand that in a context ridden with asymmetries, most people have differential access to power, economic, social and educational capital, and the know-how necessary to compete with others on an equal footing. The sudden introduction of meritocracy in such a system is in fact deeply favoritist, structurally and socially nepotistic, and not at all in accordance to the kind of laissez-faire open competition it promises to establish. Through a concise but close ethnographic and analytical consideration of the historical, cultural and structural forces present after 1945, I hope I have shed light today to a series of troubling predicaments which led to the uneven development of a closed and ambivalent society in perpetual search for its standing in the international arena. In perpetual instances of subverting the most fundamental principles of the social contract in Greece, the post-Civil War era produced the politically dangerous subject, the post-1974 epoch instituted the progressive democratic subject, while the current crisis engenders a new kind of political subjectivity, that of the parochial subject. The undifferentiated Greek, who takes no part in history or class, is not subjected to any kind of internal and international power asymmetries, and exists in a general pre-modern state of sweeping anomie. It is this kind of subject that the EU and IMF representatives are seeking to salvage from their parochial condition, marching into ministerial offices on a weekly basis to check that the targets are being met. The parochial Greek political subject is born out of the neo-colonial arrogance of second or third level officials, local politicians, and often learned academics. It is born out of voices heard and voices silenced, out of the systematic construction of imaginary dichotomies between ideal structures of modernity on the one hand and the daily struggle of people to negotiate their lives, the political and economic conditions they live in, and the ever-elusive workings of power. In epistemological terms, history can never repeat itself. If a political anthropologist's analysis is worth a penny, however, I bet that the parochial Greek subjects born out of the present crisis will eventually seek their redemption. That is, if they haven't sought it already.
Thank you very much. very much. We have a lot to discuss. There are a lot of things coming out of your presentation from a variety of different views and viewpoints. So I'll open the floor for discussion immediately. Please do identify yourselves before asking questions for the benefit of our speaker, and keep your questions as concise as possible. Nobody.
None of those.
Please, here in the front.
Thank you very much. My name is Alex Kintakalanis. I'm a sociologist at Cambridge. Thank you for the talk. It was nice to hear a talk on the crisis that put things in historical perspective. However, I have a few questions on the argument that you make. First of all, you choose to use the concept of a social contract, and you don't problematize it very much. It's a controversial concept, but at the same time, reflecting on your talk, one would be excused to think that there was no social contract, per se, the way we define it in the relevant literature, Putnam or Rawls. Or, so that's one side of things. Then you discussed a lot the absence of the welfare state. But there are various hidden ways of having a welfare state. And in a way, public employment was having a welfare state.
Yeah, this is exactly what I'm saying.
But I guess, zooming out a bit more, I think in your talk, you really elaborated on Greek particularism, which I'm not quite sure that it helps us analytically. If we look at what was happening in Southern Europe altogether, we see very similar patterns when it comes to welfare state development, or when you discuss relationships between industry and state. Essentially, this is the point of the German Marxists, Klaus Hoff, Habermas, all of these people were highlighting the contradictions that you were discussing, but in a much different setting. So I was wondering if you could reflect on these issues a bit more.
Should we take a couple of questions, or do you want to answer? Let's take
no
one
problem.
More.
Yes.
Bernard.
I wanted you to get back to what
Bernard identified himself.
Dennis Cason from the University of Warwick and the Conservatory. I wanted you to get back to your penultimate slide. I mean, not counting that as the last one, but the one before that.
This one?
No, the one, I think, the one before that, I think, yeah. I was perplexed by this because it seemed to me that whatever system Greece had got, it never did deliver that. In other words, I mean, I could never see a favourable climate for private investments and capital choosing to enter or remain in Greece. It never did. And therefore, I wasn't quite certain who this system, which seemed to be highly dysfunctional in the way you described it, was benefiting at all. So maybe it was a question about that quotation and what was being said, or what the implications of that were, because the implications of that were that somehow an equal war, as an empowering or whatever that this system was for certain people at certain times, it was delivering something, but it doesn't seem to be doing it.
Yeah.
I'm in Congress, not the same.
I'll take the question. Okay. Was there ever a social contract? Well, we have to understand this again in historical context. Greece has decided at some point that it belongs to the West. And for the sake of this belonging to the West, it has written off one third of its population, and entered a historical spiral. And I was trying to reflect upon this historical spiral. Now, the reason that Greece entered to the West, chose to belong to the West, was exactly because it chose to exist in this new world that should have been governed by the principles of the social contract. Okay, so the social contract is supposed to be this sort of par excellence principle of modern political organization. Greece chose to belong to the West because they wanted to be part of this new world where people would be equal, where competition would be open, where everybody would be free to reach the limits of what they could do. Okay, they didn't get that, I agree. So yes, and that was the point that I was trying to make. No, I was not arguing in favor of Greek particularism. I was in fact arguing exactly the opposite thing, that Greece should not be viewed as a particular case, that all these things that the Greeks are seen as doing and having done, okay, cannot be understood if you know, from a culturalist point of view, as those underdeveloped or half-developed guys on the fringes of the Mediterranean, okay? They relate to international events, they relate to geostrategic politics, they relate to how the international market worked, okay? And how ready was this country, locked in this historical spiral, to deal with these circumstances, okay? Who is this system benefiting? Well, I don't know. We should be asking this: who is this system benefiting? And I'm saying nobody. And the only groups that have been benefited by this system are local elites, which were different but the same, and that was it. You know, these are the only groups that I see as having benefited in Greece after 1945. Not even the people, because there were many people who benefited little, but at the same time there were few people who benefited a lot. Okay, I don't know if I answer your question, or if you wanted something a bit more economic.
It had to be extraordinary how poor groups managed to maintain this state of affairs, which seems to be in the interests of...
Can you speak up a bit, Bernard?
They seem to have been extraordinarily fortunate then to have maintained this state of affairs, if it were, but tiny elites who have benefited. In other words, I mean, we're now going back to something which really isn't pre-modern. So we're actually saying that despite any of the rhetoric, it was an entirely pre-modern society that was maintained by alternating elites who effectively were adopting exactly the same mechanisms, but really recruiting different kinds of allegiances of groups.
I would agree. Let me interrupt you for a moment. I agree with what you say, save the pre-modern, because I don't believe that it was because of the pre-modernity of this society that happened. It was because of, indeed, perhaps how much the society wanted to join modernity, that all this has happened.
I'm not sure if society is there, but I don't understand why. I will come back on that.
Yes.
Kevin Featherstone.
Thank you for the presentation. I think I agree with far more than I expected to. Thank you for that. I wanted to come back to the point of, let's call it a nexus between elites and people. I can certainly share so much of what you said about the, let's say, the distorting aspects of the partitocratic aspect. I've left them to wonder, Clientelism, by definition, is a reciprocal thing. Mm-hmm. So it involves a reciprocity, mm-hmm. of link between the people and the elites as patrons. Mm-hmm. I can share the description that you had of the distorting impacts of clientelistic politicians. Of the people that you quoted very effectively in the paper, what's their responsibility in the context of leading Greece towards a crisis? In other words, because clientelism is reciprocal,
mm-hmm.
is one part of the population absolved of sin, and is it simply an exploitative, extractive elite?
Mm-hmm.
What then of the wider social base that engages in a clientelistic nexus?
Yes, no, obviously. Obviously, this is not a one-way thing. It takes two to tango, and clientelism, it takes more than two to tango sometimes. But at the same time, I'm a bit reluctant to fully... Well, that sounds a bit weird, what I'm going to say, but I'm a bit reluctant to fully grant political agency to everyone, simply because we can all have agency, certainly political agency, but within a field. And when the field of action is narrow, the exercise of political agency will be. When the field is bigger, then bigger political agency will be.
Could you define that a bit more? Because
yes, what I mean.
What Kevin's saying. What is narrow political agency?
Okay. What I mean. What I mean is that we seem to be expecting, okay, the average citizen to have a full conceptualization of options, of history, of alternatives, okay, forgetting that this ground level person, okay, has to deal with everyday things, not always having the educational capital, the cultural capital, the social capital to deal with what it is. And they've got to deal also, they've got to deal with the day-to-day problems. They've got to deal with the fact that there is a history of privileged access to the state of some, and but not others, but also with their historical memory. Okay, and I think that it is very beneficial to see this from the point of individual people, because it is only from the point of individual people that we can appreciate how much leeway these people have. They don't have that much. I mean, we are asking people to say, okay, now suddenly we'll all become meritocratic, we don't want this, and take things in their own hands. I'm not entirely sure that they were fully capable of doing that.
How did this answer the question of reciprocity? I think that's yeah. the key. If one part of the population...
They were given few and they were taken
few. ...are cut out of the system,
yeah.
then obviously the system is not reciprocal. And if the system is not reciprocal, then the whole idea of clientelism...
Yeah, the system becomes matter. Reciprocal through clientelism.
But if clientelism is based on the idea of reciprocity...
No. But this is why we need the historical approach, because we need to see that through certain decades some people had access and some people didn't, and then those people who didn't, they needed to also have access, okay, and the model never changed. So this is why we need the historical perspective in order to understand how come the system survived despite periods of exclusive reciprocity or of sort of, yeah.
Can I, sorry, one second. Kevin first. Anybody else who wants to come in on this particular point, I'll take your point now and then I'll come back to Vasilis and address something.
Just one quick thing. Is it possible to say over time that this field of in which people are agents or not, is it possible to say over time that that gradually was expanded before the crisis? You've emphasized the opening of Vostok in 1981, etc. So Greece in the 1980s is not Greece of previous times,
no,
etc. So I admit that it may be a crude estimation, but is part of your argument that over time the field actually expanded?
Yes, yes, yes. And I believe that as the field expanded, political agency expanded and political subjectivity expanded. It was not the same the same kind of thing that it was in the 80s anymore. And also generally the political sphere was okay, if I say improved, you know, in relation, democracy improved, okay? But then of course there was also the economic and the fiscal aspect in it that put a halt there. And I believe it did put a halt there. I believe that the crisis throws Greece politically very many years back. Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Mm-hmm. From the Bureau of University of St. Andrews, St. Elizabeth, following Kevin, I wanted to make a very anthropological question. So when we are talking about clientelism, we are talking about the relationship nevertheless. Mm-hmm. So be it one-way relationship, two-way relationship, three, four, endless ways relationship, it is a relationship nevertheless. So I'm interested to know about the phenomenology of change when this relationship becomes problematic and throws democracy into crisis. Mm-hmm. Because you're talking about everyday human people understand the bottom-up approach. So I want to see this, and I wanted you to tell us a bit more about the phenomenology of change when this relationship, from the point of a beneficial relationship, becomes a problematic relationship and throws democracy into crisis. Because this is the title, and I would like to...
I think it was always problematic. It always worked for some and not others. That is the thing. And because it was structured alongside ideological lines, okay, especially after 1974, it worked in time depth, in perspective, because everybody waited their turn. Okay, so now these 4 years it doesn't work for me, okay, but my party is going to come to power, and this is, and then it's going to work sort of for me as well. Now, the phenomenology of change, I'm not sure I understand what you mean. Beyond that,
I'm talking about the everyday person who at one point sees the benefit of clientelism, and that nevertheless democracy is not in crisis.
Yes.
At the other point, this we have just the flip, and then democracy is thrown into crisis.
Yes, the democracy is thrown into crisis because of clientelism, but also because of the kind of clientelism that you have in Greece. Because of the fact that clientelism becomes corruption at higher levels. Okay, so if it was just everyday people employed in the public sector, okay, that would have been I suppose an economic problem, although there are many people. There is a debate between economists whether the Greek public sector is big, whether it's small, whether it's bigger than what it should be. There are people like Yordanoglou, like Tsakalotos, who say it's not. There are other people who say it is. You know, I don't want to get into this debate, but it would have been a simpler problem. What became extremely complicated was that while everyday people were busy establishing these patron-client small-scale relationships, there were also other people with considerable more power, okay, and considerable more economic and educational and social capital, that were establishing other forms of relationships with those who governed the state, okay, and that was outright corruption. Okay, and the everyday people did not mind that much because their own lives were secure. To give you a very characteristic anthropological example, we know what happened with Tsohatzopoulos, with the Minister of, you know, Defense. At ground level, people were saying, but of course we knew that Tsohatzopoulos was being bribed. Of course. I mean, that's nothing new. Okay. And if you ask these people, so why were you voter? You know, he was eating a lot, but I had also to eat. I also had to eat. So, you know, it was on the back of the everyday needs. People were giving their permission, okay, for these to become, their permission in big inverted commas, obviously, for these to happen in larger scale, because they had to deal with their own everyday problems. And at some point, this proliferated so much that there was no other way of things to be, because the state grew exponentially. So there was no other way of actually dealing with this. You were locked in this kind of relationship.
Elias Dynamis, I'm a visiting professor at the Hellenic Observatory. Now, I have to declare I'm not an anthropologist, I'm an economist. So, it seems to me.
It can happen in the best family.
Obviously, your presentation was very informative, but it seems to me that there's been another major change in 1981.
In 1981, sorry.
One can see from an economic point of view, and that is a change in the economic paradigm that was in operation in Greece.
Mm-hmm.
Most people would probably know that in 1953 there was a law which was passed that prevented governments, and that was expected by all governments in 1981, to run public deficits. The government could only have a deficit as far as public investment was concerned. This is the reason why when Kassov came to power in 1981, public debt was below 30%.
Mm-hmm.
That was a law.
I think it was 25%. Well, or something. Yeah.
It was 20, 24.
Yeah.
If you add the petrol, it will take it up.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's not the main point. The main point is that this law was abolished. There was another law which was abolished in 1981, which abolished the post of the permanent undersecretary in every ministry.
Yes.
And that was another important sort of abrogation of the existing legal state of the civil service. So it seems to me that this measure was not taken by Kassov at the time in order to restore fairness in Greek society and to employ the disadvantaged. It seems to me that Kassov followed what militant tendency used to follow in Liverpool, which was a crude, brutal in many ways for the opponents, policy of recruiting their people, their own followers.
Mm-hmm.
And that created a very fluid political class who would change allegiance depending on what that class was promised by the people in power. The result for the public sector was that the quality of the people who were employed in the civil service became much poorer. The decision making was significantly poorer. And so the economic crisis that ensued was in many ways a result of clientelism, but not in order to restore fairness in Greek society. It was in order to cement the position of the political parties in power And that was followed subsequently by the New Democracy Party, when they came to power in 2004. They were much worse in every aspect than PASOK in this sphere of their activity. That was my comment.
Yes. I think I also referred to New Democracy. I mean, I didn't leave them outside. There is a slight difference in that we are essentially saying the same thing, but there is a slight difference in perspective. You're looking into the motives. I cannot pretend I know the motives. I look at it from the perspective of how people received it.
When you say motive,
motive. Yeah, because you're saying, oh no, they didn't do it to address, they did it to cement. Perhaps they did. Using ideologies as excuses for doing various things was, you know, that happened way before. I don't know what the motive, but the larger segments of the society welcomed this, took this as a readdressing of the problem.
Kevin alluded to the reciprocity, I think, was established.
Yes.
It was a two-way.
And then, of course, because that created spheres of exclusion, also at the ground level, not only at the level of elites, which is extremely important, I think, but also at the ground level, then that became a spiral, because when Nea Dimokratia was in power, then they, you know, the blue kids had to find a job, and you know, so that was, you know, usually when we think of patronage, of client-patron relationships in anthropology, and I think I'm going to answer Stavroula's comment a bit better, because I think now I understand your question better. When we are thinking of patron-client relationships in anthropology, these are inclusive. You know, we are thinking of how somebody who has a lot of power partakes, gives a bit of this power to those below him. Patronage-led clientelism in Greece was not inclusive. It became exclusive. It became mostly a business of who will be excluded, not who will be included in the partaking of power. And because of these exclusions, you had armies of people who were then manipulating this kind of relationship to the political party, and the political party started converging, you know, they became the same, and they are the change of government was just simply down to whoever promised the most, or whoever was your MP, or whoever you knew, and you know, if they came into power. And we shouldn't be forgetting also municipalities, because municipalities was the context where this happened big time, also because of local relationships, people who just knew each other in small towns, and this kind of clientelism.
I think I like many parts of the analysis and the argument, and how you were explaining how some clientelism developed and how it got institutionalized into the relationship state and so forth. But on the big issue, the connection between the civil war and the connection with the crisis. Mm-hmm. So I'm quite happy with the middle bit, but the connections with the event at the beginning, I'm really not convinced. I would like you to explain a bit more, but let me tell you how I see it. So definitely I can see how political exclusion during the years of the Kratos της Δεξιάς in the 50s, 60s, you know, found its opposites with PASOK in the 80s, and this bloated the public sector, there was clientelism and so forth. But there are other elements, other characters. I mean, first of all, this is not unique in that experience of political but also there's other elements, especially that come in relation to the crisis. Your example of Costa saying, we didn't build the house together with the state, I built it with my own hands. It shows a complete lack of comprehension of what is a citizen and what is the state.
Mm-hmm. And yes, because the state was also always hostile to the citizen.
Yes.
And because I cannot establish a political genealogy before the Second World War, it's too far. I'm sure it does. I'm sure it can be established easily.
But I mean, then you can select an event that happened in, like, 56 and draw kind of causal claims for that. It becomes less selected. Because then surely the mistrust for the state, the lack of a, you know, sort of Western understanding of the role of citizens and so forth, despite the fact that we believe we belong to the West,
mm-hmm.
Is more of an explanation why we had so this kind of disbelief and this refusal of mm-hmm. to accept that, you know, there is a debt in the beginning, then that is you know, a debt that we created, and then that the measures we had to take, including privatizations, as part of the solution to
mm-hmm.
the debt. And
mm-hmm.
this is what explains, I think, and in my own experience, why the second and third level officials of the Troika were running into the offices, because they were also in disbelief. How can a country continue to be in crisis and to go deeper and deeper into the crisis
mm-hmm.
Without any sense of introspect mm-hmm. and sense mm-hmm. of force the solution? So I find it very hard to describe all this on the basis of an event of political exclusion, although it wasn't just an event, it was a deep mark.
It was a series of events of political
yeah.
exclusion, which were not just of one ideological.
An underlying cultural substance or whatever.
But this is why I call it a crisis in democracy,
yeah.
because I believe that the problem is that there is a crisis in democracy, that the citizens do not identify with the state, that the social, that they view the social contract as being entirely broken. They don't even believe, basically,
so how much,
it could
how much
exist.
Does this have to do with the civil war?
I can establish certainly a political genealogy in anthropological, methodological terms from that point onwards. However, a historian could establish the historical political genealogy that could go even before that. Okay? But my own informants' sort of memories and references cannot go back to the 20s. All right? So certainly I can give, as an anthropologist, I can give certainly from then onwards, okay, without, as I said, excluding historians from the debate, which could cause us. But I think that the issue here is not to establish the genealogy. Okay, we all know that this genealogy, we all know that this exists. All right, when did it start? Okay, it's an interesting question, but okay, we know it started at some point. All right, and it exists. Now the critical question is, how do we approach the crisis? And what I was trying to sort of articulate towards the end is that, okay, things got worse and worse and worse and worse because asymmetries were never properly addressed. And clientelism was not a proper way to address asymmetries, okay? Some people would say that its motive was not even to address asymmetries. Okay, I don't know. The people. This is how the people saw it. But in any case, it was not the correct way. It was a very, very crude system. Okay, now there is another way to address the asymmetry. To say, not to address the asymmetry. There is another way to deal with the crisis. To say, okay, right. Okay, from now on, the law. We're going to make the laws, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to do structural reforms, okay, whatever it is needed, okay? I'm not an economist, and I'm not going to pretend that I know what is needed, because I know that economists, between themselves, they don't agree on what is needed, okay? But suppose that we know what is needed, you know, in this peculiar universe of certainty, which doesn't exist in sciences, not even in social sciences. The issue is that not everybody is in equal footage. Okay? And people see the differences between them not as a result of this is what I could do, this is how much I could do, but they see internal differences and power asymmetries as a result of elites and governments and systems which didn't allow them to realize their potential. And so long as this exists, this kind of distrust is going to proliferate. And people will not like, you know, to see reforms, because they'll say, okay, reform. Now, what is the end result of it? My salary is going to go down. My children are going to go hungry. Somebody else's children are not going to go hungry. And the differences between me and him is not that he was better than me. It was that he was luckier. He was in a better subjective political condition. Either in the post-Second World War, which in Thessaloniki, where I did much of the field work, they also remember. That they remember, they can tell you about people. They've got a lot of, say, property. Of course they've got property. Their grandfather was a German collaborator. They remember these things. So the differences between me and him are not differences of potential. They're differences which are seen by people as having been created by an unequal system. Do you see what I mean now? Yeah.
Okay, I've got two questions.
Daniel Knight, Durham University and the Conservatory. Listening to this discussion now, I bring you back to a statement that you made in your conclusion, where you said the parochial Greek doesn't take part in history. But it seems to me...
He's seen as not taking part in history, okay? Yeah. He becomes a parochial subject. Sorry, because I didn't... Yeah, okay.
Let him ask a question, you can correct.
It seems like they are seen as partaking in history. They're actually seen as living out history on a daily basis. They're living out the consequences of historical decisions of the state, of the individual, of whatever side of the clientelistic relationship. This is an ongoing lived history. And actually, the way that the everyday, let's take it back to the anthropology, back to the ethnography, the everyday Greek talks about how they understand the economic crisis here. It is through historical decisions. It's through history itself. You know that from my own work. This is exactly what my argument is about, the embodying piece of history.
My criticism was not going to anthropology.
So would you then reassess your idea of Greek having historical subjectivity in the same way as you did with Greeks having limited political subjectivity?
No, I didn't. First of all, my criticism was not directed to anthropologists. It followed directly a quotation by a book which is called From Bust to Bust. Okay, and the quotation it was published in 2011. The authors are Mitsopoulos and Pelagidis. And they're calling the Greeks rationally ignorant and misinformed voters who are afraid of reform.
Afraid of?
Reform. And I was saying that because there are a lot of approaches to the crisis which are not anthropological, okay, out of these approaches, sometimes of academics, sometimes of officials, sometimes of politicians, okay, what we have is this new political subjectivity of the parochial subject, okay? Because those people deny to view the Greek subject as part of history. They deny this. They don't see this. They see this undifferentiated Greek subject who is living in a state of sweeping anomie, and we must change that now, suddenly. Okay? So...
Who gives them that? Who sees them as that?
Sure.
Political scientists and...
Not all political scientists.
That's my point. Political scientists and economists are actually giving them historical subjectivity. They're saying that it's the consequence of historical decisions. It's consequence of all range of that hierarchy from the top of the state down to the people themselves making decisions in a historical context. Mm-hmm. So I can't quite understand how there's no historical subjectivity or that people are being seen. What do you are saying that they're not seen?
Do do you want me to read again the quotation?
No.
because if you if I read this quotation, it's I think it's a very problematic thing. Okay. And
but
I don't think that this quotation
is whether that quotation is reflective of a wider appreciation of what the commentary
is. It is reflective
is
of some people's
authors?
No, it is reflective of some people's approach to it, some politicians' approach to it, some academics' approach to it, you know, some people. I'm not saying everybody, but some people. If you hear how certain politicians talk, you know, as if, you know, they just forget. They don't, they deny this kind of historicity and they deny this kind of subjectivity. And I'm not saying that I'm the only one, and I'm not saying that I'm the one who invented it, obviously. You know.
Okay, we have a few minutes left, and I know that both of our original question askers want to come back. So, Bernard and Alex, if you want to come back with your final questions or points, please do, and then we'll wrap it up after.
I get back to that penultimate slide thing, but I also get back to another sort of client-patron relationship.
Mm.
Somewhere in this, there were some external people as well, more external powers they were possibly, but it came up a number of times, and it was possibly the Americans, and then maybe it was the Trojans. So, I mean, if this system was delivering something to somebody, we haven't actually found out who it was delivering for at all, because it didn't even seem to be delivering anything to external capital.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't getting anything out of it. I couldn't even see that it satisfied American political interests, who hardly had any interest in what was going on, and the dysfunctional way in which Greece was behaving in relation to its next-door neighbours, and the importance in this might have had the America's geopolitical wide interest. So I still don't quite see who was being served. It comes back to the question which Kevin was also asking. That, I mean, this thing seems to be so dysfunctional that it is in nobody's interest. It is not delivering anything for anybody. And its ability to perpetuate itself remains a mystery on this basis, except that there seems to be, we come back to somebody else as being blamed, and when everybody's looking, and that's the problem with this sort of rather ethnographic sort of view of it, that the individual's always just finding somebody else, and even finding people who quote, who will say it's somebody else's fault. You go down to Clacton or somewhere like that,
mm-hmm.
and you will see exactly the same mentality. It doesn't get us very far.
Okay, let's take Alex's point as well, and you can wrap it up.
Yeah, a final point on the issue that kept coming up again and again on political agency. And I have to say, I'm not really quite sure how you define it. And I'd say, you know, a provocative counter-argument would be that people have a lot of political agency, too much of it, right? And you said, I'm quoting you more or less, where you said that the person on the street may not have the education. I disagree with that very strongly.
Mm-hmm.
I think the person on the street has plenty of political agency. You cited the anthropologist James C. Scott, who has written about the person on the street or the Malaysian
mm-hmm.
villager or whatever,
mm-hmm.
who actually has a lot of agency. The fact
mm-hmm.
that they may not get the outcomes that they want does
mm-hmm.
not is not to deprive them of political agency altogether. And, you know, if you look at, we mentioned Polovomia, the building authority.
The planning.
You know, the planning. If you think about all of those people who built homes without licenses, none of them were destroyed. If you think about all of the people who didn't pay their taxes, the little people as you define them, you know, they were exercising some agency, right? So how does that... I'm very worried about treating people as, you know, blank slates on which grand processes of capitalism are reflected upon. So, yeah, that's the final.
Yes.
The last word is yours.
I really like this question. I don't think I resorted to any dependency theories on the US. I didn't say that the US was an evil power that did anything. I just said that you cannot understand the post-Civil War climate separately from the Cold War. Okay? That was all I said. I don't believe that the problems come from the outside only.
I
But I don't believe that the problems come from the inside only. What I was trying to show was that the problems are always a kind of the result of a two-way relationship between what is happening outside, what is happening inside, and what is happening between different spheres and different groups of people. The question on political agency, it's a great question. Yes, seen from one point of view, the Greeks, as other people, had a lot of political agency, and they were even able to manipulate politics at a higher level. They were supporting the party that was giving them more, and yes, but this is why I use this this expression, the politics of the poor, because it doesn't mean that they are subjects which are sort of less knowledgeable and subjects who are more knowledgeable. And, you know, I don't see it in this kind of dichotomous way. In everyone in their own little field, they were trying to exercise maximum political agency, and sometimes they even succeeded. But in a larger context, okay, the exercise of political agency at a small field was proliferating power asymmetries. So, paradoxically, they were agents cum patients. You understand what I mean? Agents and patients at the same time. At the same time that they could exercise power, they were becoming the victims of power. And I chose to focus more on the latter than the former. Okay,
let's draw things to a close. As you can see, your remarks have generated a lot of comments, lively discussion. So we thank you very much for joining us this evening, and wish you well.
Thank you very much.